from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Gordon, filling in for Michael Krasny. In her new book, Running Out of Water, The Looming Crisis and Solutions to Conserve Our Most Precious Resource, Susan Leal starts with the question, water or oil, which is more essential in powering our society? The answer, of course, is water, but the vital resource is under constant attack. The book analyzes a global water crisis and offers examples from around the world on how communities are coming up with sustainable solutions that overcome political, financial, and cultural barriers to assure that there will be enough usable water to meet the demands of our growing population. Susan Leal is coming up next with your emails, online questions and comments, and your calls, next on Forum, after this. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Gordon. Guest this hour is Susan Leal, a trained lawyer and former health care company executive. She came onto the political scene in San Francisco 17 years ago when she was first appointed to the Board of Supervisors before winning election in her own right. She later served as city treasurer before taking over as general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. That's a city-run agency that provides water to 2.4 million residential, commercial, and industrial customers in the Bay Area. Now running her own environmental consulting firm, Leal is a senior fellow of the Advanced Leadership Initiative at Harvard University. There, she teamed up with Harvard environmental engineering professor and water expert Peter Rogers to write the book Running Out of Water, The Looming Crisis and Solutions to Conserve Our Most Precious Resource. The book points out that unless the world, from political leaders and industry executives to individuals in their own homes, unless people wake up to the fact that our water supply is limited, the consequences will be dire. Changing the way we think about water and how we use it, the authors argue, is not only doable, but imperative. Susan, welcome to Forum.
It's great to be here, Rachel.
So water is something, we start first thing in the morning with water, right? You use the toilet, you brush your teeth, you take a shower.
It's there for us. And because it's there for us, we take it for granted. And it's there for us not only in our households and all those different functions, but we also use a lot of water in the food we eat, the goods we buy. Our water footprint is not the 80 to 100 gallons a day that everybody talks about we use. In fact, in San Francisco, we're pretty good. We're way below that number. But the other number that we forget about is our water footprint. And 70% of the water that is used in the world is used for food. And our water footprint is huge.
And when you talk about that in your book, you're talking about it 1,800 gallons per day to produce the food we eat and the other things. It's not, as you said, not that 50 gallons or 100
gallons. No. The water footprint in the U.S. is 1,800 gallons per day. It's about doubled the rest of the world. It's about 1.5 times the rest of the developed world. It grows with affluence. For example, in China, the amount of beef, beef is one of the big users of water, an 8-ounce steak is 630 gallons of water. In China, where their affluence is growing, import of beef is growing, and people are eating a lot more beef by a significant percentage.
So you're making a strong case to become vegetarian.
Well, Rachel, that could be a whole hour between us two. I'm not. I am not a vegetarian, and I know viewers don't know this. I'll let you in a little secret. Rachel is. And at least I thought you were, Rachel. I don't know for sure. But
38 years.
38 years. There we go. So the issue is that we have, as you mentioned, we have a limited source. It's a finite source. It's the same amount of water that we've been using from prehistoric times, yet there's 6.7 billion people. So it's an increasing demand. And it's not only the supply, how we use up that water and the food we eat, but also how we dispose of it. You know, for every drop we use, we have to get rid of it. And sometimes the way we dispose of it, we dirty the water. We pollute the water, and we essentially poison ourselves. Just an article yesterday in the New York Times about wastewater systems that weren't properly built, big enough for the population there, and now the seafood beds around Cape Cod are being killed by by their own waste.
Hey, you talk about the finite amount of water that we have in the world. I mean, it's pretty astounding when you think of how much of the world is covered by water. But then you have to take into account oceans. You can't just go and put a straw in it and drink from there.
Right.
The glaciers, although they are melting, there'll probably be a water supply for us. But really, isn't the figure—
And other problems come with that, right?
The figure is less than 1% of total fresh water is accessible.
That's correct.
That's in your book. I mean, that's not much water there. As you said, the population's growing. It's going to go up to 8 billion people by 2025 or
yeah,
so.
That's the estimate, and it's probably a pretty sound one.
Okay, so we've got a growing population. The supply isn't growing.
Right.
So then you have to be creative.
Right. And what this book is about, it's not doom and gloom. It's not to send everybody home and to pull the covers up over their head and say, oh, that's it. This is a book about people who are creative, people who are broad-minded, people who are innovative, real-world solutions. And that's what we present in this book. We didn't want doom and gloom because we think that we just give people bad news. You don't get much positive response. And we want this to be, to use a 60s expression, somewhat of a consciousness raising. It's not meant to be an academic tome. It's meant to be a book where the solutions, people could relate to them.
Susan, let me ask you that. I mean, as you mentioned, we take water for granted, especially in this country, especially if you are not living in vast poverty on a mountainside somewhere. Mm. You go and you turn on your faucet, the water generally comes out, unless you're in, I don't know, New York City or somewhere, it comes out pretty fresh and clean. You could just drink it, particularly the people in the San Francisco Bay Area with the Hetch Hetchy water. You can do that. You talk about raising consciousness. How do you do that? How do you even get people to start thinking about it when it's not a problem for us day in and day out?
Well, we dealt with that in San Francisco. Other places have dealt with that where they had to raise the consciousness of folks. We write about a case in Brazil, which pretty much like you think they have not much in common with the slums of Brazil don't have much in common with San Francisco. They did, as we show in this book, in that both of these cases, you needed to have the awareness, the involvement, the engagement, and education of the customer so that you could get something done. San Francisco has a wonderful water supply system, but the wastewater system in San Francisco, 80% of our waste goes to a treatment plant, aging treatment plant, a 1950s era treatment plant. It's seismically unsafe. It's overwhelmed. It's inefficient. And so you had to get people to pay attention to that. So we did everything to try to get people to understand about that system. And through a public education program, it actually worked. People understood. People were willing to pay. They knew we were trying to get rates increased to fix that sewer system. And with a broad education program, people did buy into it. And people agreed for those rate increases to upgrade that system. And that's not an easy – trust me, that is not an easy lift.
Let's talk about that a little bit. In the book, you talked about how you did that. You could talk about manipulating the media. Or you could talk about – I think you used the phrase cultivating the media.
Well, we avoided
– I was one of those reporters that was cultivated. I remember I got the call, do you want to come and climb down in the sewer? It's like,
Did you go? Oh, there you go.
I'm a little claustrophobic, I found out pretty quickly as they hauled me back up. But I was warned about the albino cockroaches down there, about the rats. I really wasn't prepared, though, for the steam. I went down to a sewer with my waders on. So I didn't get the poop on my pants. I was not ready, though, for the steam that came out from the buildings there. It really is pretty claustrophobic. And the sewers are aging in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And you see that they have to be replaced. So you were doing that just not with me, but with other reporters, mm-hmm. TV, radio, newsprint, to get the word out there. So the word's out there, but there still seems to be a skepticism in the public that, boy, this is a multi-billion-dollar agency. Why on earth do we need more money? You're already raising our sewer rates. There was a backlash in San Francisco about having a freeze on rates because of that. People didn't trust in government. So how did you overcome that boundary to go, trust us this time?
Well, we were just very open about everything that went on. And we also didn't avoid that we had problems. And when I say cultivate the media, before we avoided the media, something blew up and we'd say, what blew up? Nothing blew up. And we pretend something didn't happen. We used to have basements flood with sewage in certain low-lying parts of the city. We try to pretend it didn't happen. It did happen. So instead of saying pretending it didn't happen, we had sandbag Saturdays to give people sandbags and say, yeah, we know your area is a problem. We've made some improvements under the current general, under my leadership and under the current general manager. They've made some improvements, so there aren't as many problems in those low-lying areas. But we wanted to highlight to people, we weren't going to hide from the problem. You take the case, and you want to shift it, you know, to the case in Brazil. Here, they wanted to put in an innovative approach to bring clean water and sanitation to the slums. It also relied on them engaging the public, educating the public. It wasn't much different. In fact, we could learn a lot of the U.S. could learn
less. And Brazil went a step further. It was really engaging them almost for muscle power, right? I mean, people helped in the planning of the,
sure,
of the wastewater treatment system. They had to get buy-in. I don't know if they were actually picking up shovels and picks to
build. In some cases, they did.
And so ownership means a lot.
Right. Ownership means a lot, and being open. The more you try to – what I found out is the more you try to – which unfortunately in politics we do – play games and try to like smooth over something, the more it's going to come up and blow up in your face.
Okay.
And this way, the more you're open, the more you say, hey, yeah, we got a problem here and we need your help and we want your input. And, you know, San Franciscans and I guess Brazilians are a lot alike. They're happy to tell you their opinion. And if you want to hear that, if you want to be open, I think a lot of people, especially in the engineering field, they think that they know better. And they don't need outside opinions or in that world. They don't think they need. But the more you get input and the more you let people, like, for example, the way they're designing the new treatment plant to replace the dilapidated one that's out there, a treatment plant in San Francisco that handles 80% of the city's waste. And it handles 80% of the city's waste because of geography. The things go downhill. And anyway, that plant now that they're designing will not be something that's walled off from the public. They will let the public come in and see it. They'll let the public see
and the public come in and smell it.
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, that's one of the big things. It right now, it is quite has some significant.
Right. You're
unpleasant
downwind from that on a hot
day.
Oh,
it's horrible.
Which we haven't had many of, but it can be pretty terrible.
It's horrible. I mean, one of the things when I went into that agency, I had people tell me, "Oh, it doesn't smell." I said, "Are you crazy? Of course it smells, and you have to admit it smells." And if it's a modernized plant, which it's on a way of being, the master plan is underway to make that change. It won't be an eyesore. It won't be this nasty smelling place. It'll be a destination to show people about science, about their environment, about their water.
Okay, let me ask you. I feel like we jumped kind of from point A to point C without saying how we got there, of going from tap water or resource water for irrigation, everything, and wastewater. What's the connection there from the water we consume to the water that we dispose of?
Well, every drop we use has to be disposed of.
Okay.
I mean, some gets evaporated,
right.
Some dissipates another way. But everything we use, you have to get rid of it. And how you dispose of it has a direct impact on what water is available in the future. And or on your environment. For example, San Francisco's one of the exceptions because we get our water from the High Sierra. Most people get their water from the Delta. They get their water from the Colorado River. They get their water from a number of different sources. And that water has been used a lot before it's gotten to them. It's been used by homes. It's been used by farms. And so how you dispose that water, how you treat that water really makes a difference. That's why we wrote the story about what they're doing at East Bay Mud across the bay from us here, where they actually take blood and guts from large chicken processors. Instead of letting that go through a treatment plant or letting that go into the ground to possibly pollute, they're treating it through their wastewater treatment plant and turning it into energy.
Right. I mean, this is something you wouldn't really think about. It's Foster Farms that they have this agreement with, right?
Right.
To get all the waste from the chickens that
are
slaughtered.
A million and a half tons of blood every week.
And so they use that and they, what, fire up the power, their treatment plants, right?
Yeah, they actually, the treatment plant has some excess capacity, as and there's close to 140 similar treatment plants throughout the
state.
Right,
I mean, interestingly, the excess capacity is because the economy's been so lousy and industry's been leaving the East Bay MUD.
That's region, one reason. Right? That was the main reason for East Bay MUD. But most treatment plants, you build them with some excess capacity. So if you took some of that, you took there's about 140, and they have almost all of them have some excess capacity throughout the state. And if you used and if you took food waste, and as you know, we do a lot of there's a lot of more cities are starting to do composting. You take that food waste, or that animal waste, animal byproduct waste, and you put it through those digesters. It produces it goes through those digesters three times as fast as human sewage, yet it produces three times as much methane gas, which they capture. And now East Bay MUD, instead of paying money to the power company, they're producing energy and turning it back into the grid. I mean, so they're getting rid of a nasty thing, animal byproduct, and they're producing energy.
We're also finding that kind of creative reuse in San Francisco, right, with the fats and oils from restaurants.
The fog. And it's not the thing that we've been seeing
fats,
all summer
oils,
here.
And right. Greases.
Right.
Or grease, I've been told. But that's being used for biofuel then, too.
Yes.
Happening through the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission.
Right. And one of the reasons we started that program is because San Francisco was having the problem with cities all over the world have. And that is fats, oils, and grease end up in the sewers. And when they end up in the sewers, you and maybe you weren't shown a case when you were down the sewer, but it turns into like concrete.
And they jackhammer it. Right.
You have to jackhammer out, or if the pipe is small enough, you just have to cut the pipe and remove it, which is all very expensive. Also, one of the major causes of sewer overflows throughout the country, actually throughout the world, is these pipes that are blocked by fat, soils, and grease. So in San Francisco, we got into a cat and mouse game with the restaurants and saying, don't pour your grease down the drain, you know, those fire grease, things like that. So, well, the people wouldn't pour it down their own drain. They maybe pour it down the drain down the corner. Long and short, it was blocking the sewers. So we said, okay, how do we work with the restaurants as opposed to being chasing after them with fines and the like? And it was mainly the smaller restaurants because they did not want to pay for the collection of the grease. So what we did is we hooked up with a biofuel company. And this was a couple of engineers who came up with this idea. There's some real smart folks there. And they came up with this engineer. These engineers came up with this idea. Hey, we'll get this grease. We'll sell it to biofuel producers. And the money we get from the biofuel producers will offset the cost of the collection. And that's what happened, which is fabulous.
And are people participating? I mean, I'm going to go back to that don't trust government issue. I guess for restaurants, it does come down to economics, as you said. They don't have to pay to get this taken away. They can, I don't know, tout what they're doing is environmentally sound. How much buy-in has there been?
Well, there's been real good buy-in. They're either using the PUC or they're using private vendors. The private vendors now are no longer charging. Because they know they can sell the grease, so it's a plus all the way around, and it's definitely a plus for our sewers. Less grease is going down into our sewers.
Do you know if these projects at East Bay MUD in San Francisco are they being replicated other places, not just in the country but in the world? I mean, what other models are we looking at? Are people paying attention to say, okay, this is working in this jurisdiction. Let's try it in our jurisdiction.
I think people are looking at it. They are part of this book is to get people to look at it and to use this as a roadmap, as an example for other things that have been done. You know, the work that was done in Brazil, begs a question. Why is that not being done in some other countries? It is being done in several South American countries, but there's only one country in Southeast Asia that is also using that innovative approach that they use in Brazil. But part of this book is to and what our goal of our book is again that calling for a collective action, consciousness raising, giving people a roadmap. And we're hoping that we want it to be, again, it's not an academic book. We want it to be an accessible book so people could say, well, wait a minute, maybe that's something I could try. So we're hopeful on that.
I mean, when you talk about consciousness raising, we're starting to see it in schools as well on other issues, not necessarily water, although you can walk into almost any office building or commercial building and there's a little sign over the sink, water is a precious resource, don't waste it. You go into the gym, they have it take short showers for that. In schools, we're seeing, though, with like composting programs, there are the little green compost bins for the kids with their aprons on. I'm the master composter. We've seen that with recycling in homes all over, in businesses are picking up on it. And how do you do that? How do you say, okay, let's really make sure that water is part of that equation as well? Is it going to be up to the government? Is it nonprofits? Is it a question of both government regulation and economic incentives in there? What works?
Well,
is it really different
for
each example?
I think, for example, for getting the general public involved, it's really spending time and sometimes money, not a lot of money, and getting out the message. And one of the things that I know we did is we had we started going out to kindergartens. We had a large water drop costume. I was going to wear it here today, Rachel.
But it's radio.
But it's radio.
You would have to describe it.
You would have to describe it. And then I'd be real hot sitting in here. But anyway, we went out to kindergartens. And we need to do – water utilities need to do more of that. And also public leaders, our elected leaders, need not be afraid of talk about something that might cost money or that might be a little uncomfortable. So that's really important. And then there's, you know, there's things that are happening in different when you ask what works, we go back to some of the largest use of water, which is agriculture. Remember that water footprint again. There you need some economic levers or some regulatory levers to get people to change. And what we've seen with some of those levers, like in our case in Nebraska, with a little bit of an economic incentive, the farmers in Nebraska dramatically increased their water use. In Southern California, a regulatory mandate as well as some economic incentive, and they improved their water use. And even a 10% increase in agricultural water use will make a big difference in averting this crisis.
Okay, I want to get back to some of those examples in a little bit. But if you're just joining us on Forum, we're talking to Susan Leal. She's a former general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. And now she's a senior fellow at Harvard University. And she's written a new book called Running Out of Water, The Looming Crisis and Solutions to Conserve Our Most Precious Resource. We'd like to hear from you, our callers, about water conservation, about government regulation, about what you're doing to save water, and is it even part of your consciousness? You can join our discussion by calling us at 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can visit our website, kqed.org/forum, to give us your thoughts about this. Susan, again, on your book, you go all over the world looking at the examples of what works, what doesn't, what are some of the constraints, how you have to get the government agencies involved as well as the individuals in that. And I wanted to go, before we run out of this portion of the show, have you seen yourself changing the habits too? Quick answer on that, personally.
Yes. Yes. I think about a steak before I order it.
Okay.
And it's not only a health thing. I think about how much water is used.
Okay.
And so I do think about it.
Great. And next, again, we want to hear from you. If you want to call us, you can try us at 866-733-6786. I'm Rachel Gordon. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Gordon, filling in for Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Susan Leal, former general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission and a senior fellow at Harvard University now. She co-authored a book with Peter Rogers called Running Out of Water, The Looming Crisis and Solutions to Conserve Our Most Precious Resource. Susan's saying that it's not a book of gloom and doom, but it's a book about hope of what people, individuals, governments, industry can do to try to avert the looming crisis of having not enough water. I'd like to go right away to a first call. Frank in San Francisco, you're talking about the need for laws. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, hi. I work for, regarding the restaurant industry and the grease waste and the water waste coming from restaurant industry, I work for one of the three major companies here in the Bay Area. We service grease interceptors and grease traps. The distinguishing difference would be the grease interceptor is usually a tank that's under the sink or even a big, large tank that could be outside underground, anywhere from 50 gallons to 10,000 gallons. All of the water waste, the liquid waste from the restaurants go through the grease trap, separates the oils, the fats, and the grease, and it sends the water to the sewer system. You mentioned that there has been some type of a shift where some laws are coming down to get restaurants to properly recycle their grease. Me being in the business for 3 years, I want to say that it's extraordinarily difficult to get a restaurant owner to sign up and to pay for a service to get the grease trap serviced unless they are getting heat from the city or unless they are getting inspected.
Frank, is there some blowback, though, from restaurants? I mean, it's just let's talk about San Francisco, for an example. There seems to be so much anger that City Hall is coming down on them for everything from providing health care and sick days off for their employees. You can go down the list of regulations and requirements. Is this getting rid of grease properly just one more issue?
Well, I can answer that real quickly. Again, 3 years in the business, seen every part of the business, and restaurant owners and food manufacturers, again, unless they're getting heat from the city, unless there are laws, unless they've been inspected, they're just not interested in hiring a company to properly dispose of the grease trap waste. So what happens in many cases is the grease trap gets full, it starts to corrode, it causes plumbing problems, then they'll finally call you. But that could be years or months before that happens.
Right. The Public Utilities Commission in San Francisco has an innovative program, I think, to help restaurants get more state-of-the-art traps right now that are easier to deal with, aren't they?
Rachel, we could – and thank you to our call for that question. We could spend quite a bit of time talking about the grease that goes into the system. There's two types of grease, and the one is called yellow grease and one is called brown grease. And the one that Frank is talking about is called brown grease. And that is where it goes down the drain and it ends up in that interceptor. And that is some really nasty stuff. The PUC has just started to test, had some successful test runs on processing that grease. That is the most difficult to deal with. The one grease that was the one of the most the biggest amount is the what is called the yellow grease, and that is the stuff that's from the fryers, which is easily stored in tanks or in drums, and that can be pumped out or and taken away from the restaurant. That where we've had a lot of success in removing that from the system, and again, that was a big source of the fog. Down in the sewers, blocking the sewers. The brown grease, I know that the PUC has had some successes in that, and we're hoping that working with the restaurants will get some movement there. It's more than we put a lot of heat on people. We raise fines, but we find out that a cat and mouse game doesn't work as well as a partnership.
Thank you for your call. I'd like to go now to an email and turn the direction a little bit, Susan, to the economics. This is from Jason in San Francisco. He says, here's a perfectly fair and immediate solution to water issues in California. Charge every user the same. Residents, farms, industry, all other utilities are this way. Why not water? I despise the fact that as a resident, I am charged thousands of times more for my water than farmers. My water bill is over $100, and I have a low-flow everything and two-way flush toilets. Let's see everyone take the measures I take. What is this about farm subsidies and water?
That would be I have some agreement with the listener, but think about you better. I think we all need to think about that a little bit more, and that is our food is relatively cheap. There's still people, of course, hungry in the city and in the country, but the food is relatively cheap. And the food would not be relatively cheap if you charged the same amount for farmers that you did charge for city residents. That being said, it's important that the farmers have some economic incentive. We've seen it in whether it was in Australia or whether it was in Imperial Valley with an economic incentive. People treat that water with more respect, make better use of it. So there's a fine line. You're never going to get, you never want water to be the same cost in the farms as you've got in the cities, because your food would be, the cost of food would be off the hook.
Okay, you spent a lot of time on your book about what is happening in the Imperial Valley. Talk to us a little bit about the economic incentives. I mean, that was a place that was just wasting water like crazy.
Well, and they still, their water use is still not, I would believe, up to snuff. They're doing a better job, but it was part economic. It was part regulatory. This was a case where the federal government and the state government got together and literally took charge. And that's a fine thing when actually people stand up and take charge.
Well, let me backtrack one moment. Sure. The Imperial Valley, it's not a verdant, lush farmland anyway, right? They had to take water from the Colorado River.
It was a
farmland because the soil looked like it was the right kind of soil to do farming.
That's
there.
That's
correct. But it's not somewhere where you just go, I'm going to grow some peas, right?
No. It is, and to put it in perspective, is the largest user of the Colorado River. It uses enough water to provide water to New York City three times over. They use 3 million acre feet of water and a huge amount of water. They are now finally doing some improvements, but it took many years by the state government and finally the federal government, both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, really putting their feet to the fire and getting them to improve. And then it was an economic incentive. They were able to sell water to one of the urban counties and use that money to start putting in some efficiencies. But it is still an inefficient system, but it's improving. But you need to start somewhere. They got some improvement, and that's where we said that was a lesson.
I mean, the deal you talked about with the urban counties with San Diego is both innovative and extremely controversial, right?
Oh, yeah.
San Diego needed the water. Imperial Valley had extra water from the Colorado. And as you said, the government's gone on them and said, knocked their heads and said, you got to do something. You just can't take this water and waste it as they were.
Right.
How's that playing out, though, to this day? What is it, 15 years ago or so that the deal was struck? A long time ago.
Well, it was struck a while ago. It really didn't get voted in until 2003. There's been legal challenges to it. But despite the legal challenges to it, Imperial is now on track to improve its water use. And that to me is why we put it in the success column, because you saw somebody who was one of the biggest water wasters. They were found by the state board to be in violation of the state constitution of being a water waster, and you saw an improvement. It's just like what we saw in Australia. They got an economic incentive, and so you got people that they improved. The crops, they went to more value crops. They even improved their in growing of more thirsty crops.
I thought one of the interesting segments of your book was took place in Rising City, Nebraska. I don't know if you actually went and visited there, but
my co-author spent a bit of time there, and it's wonderful to have this wonderful erudite man from Harvard in his British accent explain his time in Nebraska.
Right, you talked to a farmer there, focused on him, Eugene Glock.
Name, Mr. Glock,
and Mr. Glock to you. He though did something that his neighbors are starting to look at and say, hey, this is something that might be able to work with us. It was just looking at a different way to water his crops.
Right. Mainly. See, in all these stories, in almost every one of these stories, it's not an issue that we need new technology. It's applying available technology. And that's what Mr. Glock did.
Simple irrigation, right? Water when you need it.
Yeah, he used a system that was inexpensive. He used gadgets that were inexpensive to measure the soil moisture and the crop growth, and used the center pivot system, and really increased his productivity by a significant amount. At the same time, decreasing his water use. Now, that was an economic incentive because of prices in energy at that time. So that's what started to motivate it. But he was the leader in that, and it started to spread throughout his area.
I mean, it seems something that homes and businesses can do close to home here in San Francisco just with an irrigation system, although you're talking about upfront costs for savings later. It seems sometimes hard to convince people that might be the right thing to do.
Right, and that's why in the case of Imperial Valley, they got that money, some of it from the Met, the large water district down in Los Angeles, and which includes San Diego, and then some from San Diego County Water Authority. And that money is to go directly to efficiency measures.
Okay. Along the same lines, we have an email from John in San Jose. Just an observation, he says. Citizens are always asked to find ways to conserve water, yet I pass by commercial parks and buildings that have irrigation systems running water all over the sidewalk and into the gutters almost every night. When will cities start to crack down on these offenders?
I'm one of those people that's standing there in my soapbox screaming about that as well. And there's no excuse for it. And if you're going to talk the talk, you got to walk the walk.
I know when you go around San Francisco, you see a lot of the watering trucks from either the Rec and Park Department or the Public Works Department that always say recycled water.
Don't start me, Rachel. That could be the next 20 minutes of the show.
Okay. I want to get to another call if we may. This is from Michael in San Jose. He's talking about water quality, fluoride and chlorine. You're on, Michael. How are you?
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you for waiting.
No problem. Thank you for the important subject and taking my call. I'm interested to learn from your speaker on water quality and specifically fluoride being added to the water, which has been banned in Europe for a couple of decades now. Even the ADA has informed dentists that they should be cutting back since water is used in soft drinks, it's used in beer, it's used in bottled water, it's used across the planet, that we're being overdosed with fluoride, which is a toxic substance. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, I do at the PUC, when I was running the PUC, we looked to scientists that not only scientists in our agency, but the state of California's health folks as well for direction on that. We do fluoridize our water, as do many agencies throughout California. It is not we have not gotten the word that you have that fluoride is should be removed from the water. I tell you, we take water quality. I know in San Francisco and all the agencies throughout California take water quality very, very seriously. San Francisco, for example, I know on average the water that comes to our 2.4 million customers is tested no less than 80,000 times over a course of a year for the different contaminants.
Something you have to pay attention to.
So we do take the water quality seriously, and again we defer to scientists, not only the agency but the state health officers.
Is that your question answered there?
No, just one more question really quickly and very briefly is how can we take initiative to contact the PUC and the Water Quality Board to provide the documentation that's in Europe already and has been in Europe for a long time with that information so they could act proactively in determining the toxicity of fluoride?
I think you should contact sfwater.org.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are scientists there. I know that they interface with scientists throughout California, throughout the U.S., and I know that several of our scientists we're pleased to have at the PUC, the agency that provides water to us here in San Francisco. I know they interface a lot with scientists in Europe, so I'm sure they'd be happy to hear your information you have.
Thank you for your call. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Susan Leal, former general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, and she's co-author of the new book, Running Out of Water, The Looming Crisis and Solutions to Conserve Our Most Precious Resource. We'd like to hear from you to join our discussion. You can call us at 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Or you can visit our website, kqed.org/forum. You can add your comments and questions there. We're talking a little bit at the top of the hour, Susan, about population, and we're seeing it going up to about 8 billion people probably in our lifetime. So here's a question, an email from Mark saying, are there too many people, not enough water? Shouldn't our focus be on stopping the overpopulation that is decimating our waterways and the other components of our natural environment?
Well, I think that we could always have a discussion about that. I am not qualified to talk about population growth per se and how you deal with that issue or population growth in certain areas. But I believe that what we can do is make sure that the resource we have, we treat it properly. And we, in some cases, we're afraid to reuse it. One of the solutions we came up with, but we explored and we described, was in what they've done in Orange County. Orange County, the home of Disneyland, and what we know in Northern California is conservative politics. Their water agency, their elected water board, did some pretty forward-looking stuff, and they recycled their water. And so instead of relying as much on water being pumped from the north, water from the Delta, water from the Colorado River, they're also looking to recycle water to help make up the gap. And that's what we have to look at as well. We have to not be afraid of being cutting edge.
I mean, you found that recycling water also in Singapore and St. Petersburg, Florida. So you say, don't be afraid of recycling water. Is there any reason we should be afraid of it? Is there a health problems associated with that?
Absolutely not. I mean, if it's a – you know, any recycled water process should definitely be have health officers involved and scientists involved and microbiologists involved and have all the proper steps. But I will tell you, and I know it's tough for people to believe, especially those of us that are drinking our gorgeous Hetch Hetchy water. But when the water comes into Orange County, it basically is coming from three sources. It's coming from the Delta. Okay. It's coming from the Colorado River. And then it's water that's recycled that goes into their groundwater underwater storage basin. And that recycled water has been treated in a fashion, and in our book we describe it in the pretty basic steps it goes through. They're basic steps, but they're very intricate steps that clean that water to a distilled water level. Distilled water level, so that when the water is going into the water treatment plant before it's finally distributed to all the residents, the cleanest water going into that water treatment plant from those three different sources is the recycled water. And in Singapore, the recycled water using the same process they use in Orange County is so clean, it is such of high quality that it's mainly used by the semiconductor industry in Singapore.
And also has no gum in it, I bet. Can't spit that out. I mean, Singapore is an interesting example as well because it was their problem, right? It was lack of storage space, and they were importing water from Malaysia, and there were political implications with that.
Right.
They didn't want to be beholden to another country for something so vital as water.
Right. And with Singapore, they also had still the nightmare of World War II, and it's still branded in their psyches of what happens when their water got cut off during the World War II. So they really understood water security. It was up front in their brains, and they were not going to be relying on another country where they had some political challenges with.
Okay. I want to go to another caller. I want to bring in Genevieve from Petaluma. Genevieve, if you're talking about Petaluma, it has a water, unique water recycling system. Can you tell us what that's about?
Well, I'm not an engineer. I'm a walker, and Ellis Creek Water Recycling Facility has miles and miles of tracks for people to walk on and observe the natural wildlife. And it's become a very important part of Petaluma because it serves as a place for people to go and have an experience of what it is to be part of a system that, the water is rushing underneath you. You're walking across these paths that have grates, and the water is rushing underneath you. And there's not an odor that I noticed, and everybody likes being there, and lots of organizations have walks, fundraising events, races. There's a school right next door to it. One of the charter schools has opened up right next door to the water treatment facility. It's incredible. It's an honor.
So that's one thing that Susan was talking about in San Francisco with a new sewage treatment plant, is to kind of give people an up-close view of it to have them have buy-in ownership of the system, to know that it's not just something that's once they flush the toilet, that's it, that it goes somewhere and it means something and that it can be reused after it's
right.
processed.
We want to get
Thank you for your call.
Thanks a lot for that. One of the things we want to get rid of is that out of sight, out of mind. You flush it, it's gone. In some ways, that's great. But we need to understand what happens to that water. One of the things in this the water treatment plant that that the plans are underway for, it will be a destination spot where you could go and see how that water is processed. And I think a lot of people will find it fascinating. Find what we do with biofuel. Find out how much water we clean. It's a good job that they do.
Great. I'd like to go to another call. This is Wes. Wes, thank you for joining us. How can we help you?
Great. Well, thank you for the show this morning. I wanted to talk about water conservation and the ability for water utilities to be incentivized or even required to conserve. I know that a lot of the utilities around the area have conservation programs, but I would like to see something more like the energy decoupling, where there's a requirement to conserve as kind of part of the business plan so that they can't just make more and more money by selling more and more water. I wondered what your guest would think about trying to decouple that industry.
I'm not sure I totally understand the question, but I believe that most water utilities, the way they set their pricing, is that the more water the customer uses, they pay more to, and that tiered pricing is to incentivize the user to use less. And so because there isn't that much more water. In fact, there's, again, as we said at the top of the show, it's a finite source. What we have is what we have. It's less than 1% of the water on the earth is actually available to us. And with climate change in the West, climate change in the Western region is no longer if it's a when, and how drastically it's going to affect our watersheds.
Wes, thank you for your call. Let's go to another email. This came from C. I'm not sure what that stands for, but to the guest, Susan Leal. What value would widespread adoption of residential gray water systems have in conserving this resource? What would these systems involve in terms of cost, and how would they work? And what other obstacles are there to implementing this conservation strategy? So first, can you tell us a little bit, Susan, about what gray water is?
Well, gray water would be, say, water that's coming off a laundry. Or it's not what you call what stuff from your toilet. It would be, you know, from your dishwasher or your laundry. And that is water that you can treat at a much lower it requires much less intensive treatment, and it could be then you could possibly use it for gardening. I know that the PUC and other utilities are doing things where people are collecting rainwater. They're giving out these quote unquote rain barrels for people to collect water. I know there is some gray water systems that are being put in residential. I think that it is a positive thing to do. It's not that easy to implement that and to have that consistent in every residence. I think if you're going to think about saving water, make sure you start by composting. That we have a mechanism in place. The city, working with our private collection company, has a composting system. That is a lot of water that goes into that wasted food and how it's disposed. So that also has a big impact also on greenhouse gases, that food waste.
Right. I also like to go to a caller, Adrian, who's going to talk about conservation through landscape initiatives. Thank you and welcome to Forum.
Hi, my name is Adrian. Thank you for this show. We planted, we remodeled our garden, and we won full native plants, California natives. After 2 or 3 years of drip irrigation, which uses a fraction of what our previous grass used to use, mm-hmm. The plants are fully established and don't need any water, or maybe once a week in a hot summer week. The savings are humongous, and the garden is much more beautiful and full of birds and insects. And so most of our water for gardening is for our tomatoes and our fruit trees, which are also drip irrigation system with mulch, so there is not evaporation. Irrigation at 2 or 3 in the morning when it's the coolest, so less evaporation. And I think incentivizing those kind of gardening through maybe tax incentives or so will be a way for big savings in our water usage. And I have a very small comment about fluoridation. Only a handful of countries in the EU went away from fluoridation because they have an awesome healthcare system and everyone has access to the dentist. It's not our case in California, unfortunately. A lot of kids still have a lot of cavities because they don't have access to a dentist. So I think fluoridation in San Francisco, Santa Clara County, and many other counties in California is a social imperative. Thank you.
Thank you for that call. We're also seeing that landscape architects now have LEED certification or are akin to that, saying that they're going to be environmentally sound for
what,
them.
What he was saying was music to my ears. And one of the things we described in the book is what several jurisdictions are doing throughout the U.S. where they're actually paying cash for grass. Now, that may have a different connotation
right.
here
in
Oakland or in San Francisco, but this is for rebates for people to rip out grass and then put in drip irrigation. And there's programs in place in Marin. It was started mainly in Las Vegas and in Marin and Los Angeles, all over California. And it's we need to get in touch with that and make sure that we have a landscape that reflects the climate they're in. And this all goes back again to a lot of the themes we have in our book, and that it's our water.
Water, and there are things we can do as individuals, as
right.
governments, as businesses
right.
to try to conserve.
And ask our governments and ask our utilities, are they doing all they can?
Well, Susan Liao, I'd like you to thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. Susan Liao is a former general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. She's now a senior fellow at Harvard University and co-author with Peter Rogers of a new book called Running Out of Water: The Looming Crisis and Solutions to Conserve Our Most Precious Resource. It's a good read. It's an easy read. I think you can find
Great.
It on Amazon and in your individual independent bookstores.
It's at the bookstores, too.
Thank you for joining us. That's going to wrap it up for this hour of Forum. I'm Rachel Gordon, filling in for Michael Krasny again. Susan, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanakos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.